Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. In 2009, Alaska experienced the largest single-year increase in gonorrhea since the 1970s. One way to help address this problem is to educate the public on the problem and control efforts. If you got questions today, please call us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1@kska.org. My guests today are Joe McLaughlin. He's the state epidemiologist for the State of Alaska Division of Public Health, and Susan Jones. She's manager of the Section of Epidemiology, HIV, and the Sexually Transmitted Disease Programs. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
It's first time for both of you.
It is.
We've had the epidemiology, several epidemiologists on here. I have a fond feeling about epidemiology in general, but it's the first time for the two of you. Joe, how long have you been with the state?
So I've been with the state officially since 2003, but I came up to Alaska as a CDC Epidemic Intelligence Service Officer in 2001.
Okay. And Susan, you've been,
I've been with the state since 1980. I started in Kotzebue as a public health nurse and actually was on public radio up there a little bit promoting.
No way.
Yep. During the GC outbreak in the 70s and early 80s. So I was a public health nurse, and I've been with the Section of Epidemiology since 1996.
Great. Well, let's start with epidemiology and what the state is doing. What's the function of epidemiology within the state and purpose?
Sure. So I can go ahead and start with that. So just sort of briefly, epidemiology is the study of the distribution and determinants of disease in populations. And so the Section of Epidemiology is one of several sections within the Alaska Division of Public Health. And our section is tasked with overseeing infectious disease outbreak response and surveillance, HIV, STD programmatic work, immunization programmatic work. We have an environmental public health program, and then we also have an injury surveillance program.
Why do we need to monitor these things? What's the advantage?
So there are a lot of reasons why we monitor disease trends. One of the things that we do with the information is we track whether or not there are acute changes in disease trends. And, for example, if you've got sort of a baseline level of disease that you expect in the population – and then the trend sharply increases, that suggests that there could be an outbreak of a disease going on. A good example would be salmonella infection. If you have a certain baseline rate of salmonella and then, boy, you see this big spike that occurs very quickly, that could be a tip-off that there's an outbreak going on. So certainly detection of outbreaks, that's one of the key reasons we monitor these disease trends. We also monitor the trends to provide feedback to healthcare providers. Helps them know what's happening in the state with respect to these diseases. With respect to sexually transmitted diseases, there are also reasons related to rapid response to any individual cases that might occur. Certainly syphilis and HIV, we try to rapidly go ahead and contact the person and try and do partner notification. We also do that for other STDs like chlamydia and gonorrhea as well.
Also, with the HIV, looking at the disease trends, it directs our programs. So it directs the prevention program by looking at the data on who has been reported, what are the risk factors. Then we know how to target prevention programs. And it's the same with the STDs. It gives us the data that we need to say, this group is at high risk, this group is at high risk. This is where we need to do some targeting of prevention efforts.
Yeah. You know, and I'll also say that the original reporting laws were really around the quarantinable diseases. So there are certain diseases like cholera, plague, and yellow fever that are quarantinable. In other words, if there is a person who has come in contact with an ill person, that you know, those people would be placed in quarantine, and certainly the ill people would be placed in isolation. So that's another purpose for disease reporting. And then we also do disease reporting to help monitor the effectiveness of prevention and control programs, like, for example, vaccine-preventable diseases.
Mm-hmm. So whether this is a cost-effective way to be doing something.
Right.
We need the numbers to see.
Right.
So the other thing that you might look at, especially with STDs, is that we look at complicated infection from chlamydia and gonorrhea. That is an indicator on how well we're doing with identifying disease early so it doesn't become complicated as in pelvic inflammatory disease. So if we have a lot of pelvic inflammatory disease being reported, which we do not, but if we did, we would know that we're really not catching people early enough in the infection. It's starting to become a complicated infection.
How are these monitored? What are the techniques that you use?
So, you know, we have a list of about 56 reportable infectious diseases, and they're reportable by healthcare providers and by laboratories. And the provider reports come in through one of three different mechanisms. It can be, you know, the provider actually calling in, so by telephone saying, I've got a case of, you know, syphilis, confidential fax, and then also by mail. In terms of laboratorians reporting lab-confirmed cases to us, we get that information through mail, and we also have an electronic laboratory reporting system that we've developed in the state for the major hospitals.
And I'd just like to add, there has been some concern among people about the confidentiality of the information that's reported to us. The room where the reporting takes place is protected by locked doors that are only accessed by a few people. And when the office is closed, it's protected by laser beams that is set up with an alarm system. So we take the protection of this information to be quite serious. And we have all of these protections in place.
And as I recall, also, some of the information may come in from lab reports, may not necessarily have people's names on it. You're just monitoring the number of positive cultures with pertussis, for example, or salmonella. Not necessarily names, unless you wanted to get into some disease.
Yeah, and in terms of the data that comes into us, those data are, you know, it's mandated by law that providers and laboratorians report, and it's actually name data.
Okay.
But in terms of the information that goes back to healthcare providers, to the public, to inform folks of what's going on, that is all de-identified.
Mm-hmm.
I think early on when AIDS was reportable in the early 80s and then in 1999 when HIV became reportable, we switched from anonymous reporting to named reporting.
Right.
And some people even ask, why can't this be done by the private sector in some format? I mean, I know the answer to that, but this is not the kind of information that any hospital, any physician is able to gather. And they may see a case of gonorrhea, but they don't know that they're in the middle of a big outbreak of gonorrhea because they don't know what other patients are having. Somebody's got to centralize this information.
Well, I think that there's, like Dr. McLaughlin mentioned, there's several reasons to report diseases. And one of the reasons to report is to have a public health response to the report.
Right.
And a public health response is pretty time consuming. Most private providers wouldn't be paid sufficiently for the amount of time that they put into doing a public health response. Mm-hmm. So the public health response is a combination of things. It's to assure that the person is in care, has been properly treated depending upon the disease, whether it's bacterial or viral, and then also to help identify the partners of the person that's infected.
Yeah, and I think it's important to go back to the purpose of the reporting. As Susan said, it is for rapid response often in terms of outbreak investigations or, you know, quarantining folks who might have been exposed to a quarantinable disease. So, and that is, you know, by law set up to be public health officials who do that type of work. And, you know, primary care physicians and other physicians really don't have the training or expertise to do that, nor is it within their jurisdiction to do that type of work.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that we've not addressed specifically with epidemiology is it may lead to ways to stop outbreaks or to recognize problems. I'm thinking about E. coli infections in beef, for example,
right,
and some of the prion diseases. And so it leads to some public health advances that prevents quite a bit of illness. I mean, it really is, I think, very, very cost effective when you look at it in that respect.
That's a really good point. I think that's one thing that people who don't really understand what the health department does in terms of outbreak response, it's one thing that maybe they're not really clear about. But one of the things that we do if we have an outbreak is oftentimes we'll do investigations that involve actual studies like case control studies or cohort studies that allow us to identify risk factors for illness. And so when we come up with specific risk factors, when we develop and understand those risk factors for diseases, we are able to implement changes. I think a really good example is in 2004, Alaska had its first outbreak of a bacteria called Vibrio parahemolyticus, and that was associated with consumption of raw oysters that were harvested in our own waters. And prior to this outbreak, that was the first time, prior to this outbreak, we really felt that Alaska waters were too cold to harvest, to sustain levels of Vibrio parahemolyticus that were high enough to cause disease. But bang, this outbreak happened. And so what we were able to do is implement control measures whereby oyster farmers were then dipping their nets down below the thermocline. And once those nets got below the thermocline, then those oysters didn't collect that bacteria. So that's just one example of an intervention method that has helped prevent further cases from occurring.
Well, I think the other example that you would have is the HIV outbreak when it first began, and physicians were actually looking at the disease and what was happening. And as they began to learn more and more, then they could direct some prevention efforts once they found out that one of the highest risk were men mm-hmm. who were having sex with men. Mm-hmm. Then there was an education program mm-hmm. that began. Mm-hmm. And that is the rapid mm-hmm. response
right.
and trying
yeah.
to prevent more infections. And then, of course, there's always yeah. the prevention of complications.
Now, you could easily argue that HIV is disastrous and is widespread. It could have been much, much, much wider widespread if it wasn't recognized fairly quickly through epidemiology. Some risk factors that led to understanding and eventually defining what the problem was.
Right, and it was also an opportunity to get the consumers or the people with HIV involved in the education right. because a peer-to-peer education really worked well in a lot of those environments. So part of the public health response sometimes is learning what's going to work well to control this infection.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our topic today is sexually transmitted diseases. We're going to spend quite a bit of the next several minutes talking about a recent resurgence of gonorrhea in the state. So if you've got questions or comments along this line, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Two phone numbers, locally 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1, that's all one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@ksk.org. Another thing that the state division of, I'm not saying the section of epidemiology, does is it tries to keep providers and healthcare individuals up to date on what's going on. And what led us to this program today was a recent report in your bulletin. So the purpose of these the state is also to kind of keep people informed of what's going on.
Right. We publish an epidemiology bulletin, and it's really intended to serve as a forum for the rapid communication of reports of public health information to Alaskans. And we typically gear these epi bulletins primarily to providers and really primary care providers. But really, we recognize that our audience is much broader than just providers. And anybody who is interested in signing up for these epidemiology bulletins can do so for free. And all you need to do is just go to our section of epidemiology webpage, which is www.epi.alaska.gov.
And just a reminder also, there's several links to these kinds of websites placed on our website if you would like to link directly from there. All right, so let's get to this issue, a recent bulletin that talked about a sharp increase in gonorrhea. What do we need to know here?
Well, this was first discovered actually last summer. We were looking at the data, and we saw that we know that gonorrhea is episodic. It comes and goes. It kind of is like a boom and bust with the economy of Alaska. So during the oil pipeline, we had a boom of money and a boom of gonorrhea. Last summer, we noticed that there was an increased incidence of gonorrhea infection in southwest Alaska. East-west. I got southwest right.
Southwest,
there.
Yes.
I always get my east and my west mixed up. And we looked down more at the data trying to figure out exactly where this came from, and we found out that it was in the Bethel-Wade-Hampton census areas. And it was hidden. And when we looked at that region specifically, which we don't normally do unless we see a spike, we saw that there had been an increase over the last year in that area, but it had been buried in the state numbers because the state numbers had stayed stable, which meant that other parts of the state, there wasn't such an increase. So we looked again after we got the 2009 data completed and saw that there was a huge number of GC cases, gonorrhea cases. For Alaska, a huge number is around 1,000 cases in a year, where it had been around 600, a little bit less, a little bit more. To have that big jump was pretty significant. And we looked at the incidence of the gonorrhea in all the regions across the state, and we found that there was an increase in the rates in every area except for in interior Alaska. We looked more at the data, and this was just really a quick look at trying to figure out what was going on. We found that 67% of the cases were in the Alaska Native population. We started talking to providers back in the summer in the Bethel area, and we sent out folks from our office to try and characterize the infection in Bethel and to see if there was a difference in the testing in the Bethel providers, so to see if it was a bias, a surveillance bias or not. And in looking at the testing in the Bethel area, we found that the Bethel providers weren't doing any testing that was any differently. They were just finding more positive tests. So when we saw the same increase across the state, we looked at the test numbers again. And we could look at the test numbers through the state public health lab. They usually capture about half of the gonorrhea cases. The rest of the gonorrhea cases are captured by other labs that don't use the state, other providers who don't use the state public health lab. We found the same information to be true for the state public health lab, that there was no real difference in testing over a period of time, but there were more positive tests. So we talked to providers, and providers were telling us that their patients were having milder symptoms of gonorrhea. Some patients were coming in for other things and just happened to get a test, and it was positive. Especially in men, that the symptoms were so mild that they would come and go and they would think, oh, maybe it isn't anything. So this is not normally what you think of when you think of gonorrhea. You think of burning on urination and discharge that is green in color and other symptoms that are something that you don't want to ignore. So we thought, okay, so we've got more cases. More cases are statewide. There's no difference in testing. We have providers telling us people have milder symptoms. So then we looked at what are some of the other factors on the data that we have that's reported to us, and we found that 30% of the people that had gonorrhea also had chlamydia infection, both in 2009 and 2008. That's a pretty significant percentage. So we thought we need to get this information out to the providers right away. We've had several meetings with them, and we did the bulletin that said, look, we have a spike in gonorrhea cases. And because it was such a significant spike, we did a press release. So we've tried to get information out and to the press so the individuals who are at risk would also know who they are so they could go in and get tested. So here's who they are. They're individuals who are younger than 25, both male and female, although the case reports for 2009 went up into the 60s, people were in their 60s with gonorrhea. Those numbers in that age group were pretty small. Most of the individuals were under the age of 25. The Alaska Native population is harder hit than other races. 67% is in the Alaska Native population. And black individuals have a higher incident rate, too. So basically, those are the groups that if you're sexually active, you're not sure who your partner is, if they have STD or not, then we're saying go in and get a test.
You ever think about being an epidemiologist?
I've done a few interviews lately. I'm sorry. It all comes off the top of my head.
No, I just meant that was a perfect example of what happened to you. So we know a little bit about who and what and where. So why?
Yeah, now that's the question. I think that we have some hints on why. And the hints are the providers who are telling us that this gonorrhea is not as symptomatic as other gonorrhea. So
sure.
Individuals aren't being driven in to get the infection taken care of right away, and they're more likely to spread it around. And they're in a young – it's a young population. It's a sexually active population.
Right.
But, you know, I think the bottom line is that we really don't know why. That's and that's certainly something that we've looked at, whether or not we can do some sort of a – you know, a study that would help us try and understand, you know, some of the risk factors for this particular gonorrhea that's circulating.
So we have a little study or collection of data in the state with some providers that look at some sexual behaviors and sexual risk factors, but it's only characteristic of about 13% of the reported gonorrhea cases for 2009. So I don't know that we can say this is broad, but it's the things that you would say, yeah, if you have sex with somebody who has symptoms, yeah, it could be that you're having sex with someone with gonorrhea. That's what this data says in this group. Also, if you've had gonorrhea or chlamydia within the past year, you're more at risk of getting it again. If you have many sexual partners, you're more at risk. If your partners have other sexual partners, you're more at risk. If you have a lot of sex with a lot of different people, you're more at risk. So those are all data that's in that small group of the CDC Infertility Prevention Project that tells us these are some of the these people are more likely to have gonorrhea than other people.
Well, you're going to maybe have to correct me, but I'm going to guess that more young adults having sex today use condoms or something else to prevent sexually transmitted diseases than they did in the past. Am I right or wrong? And if I'm right, how does that factor in?
I think the Youth Behavioral Risk Survey shows that on condom use. They ask that. It doesn't.
Is that effective, I guess, is what I'm getting at, preventing the spread of gonorrhea and chlamydia?
If you use the right condom, it is. And if you use the condom correctly, you have to put it on early in your sexual activity. You don't want to exchange any bodily fluid. You have to take it off after you're done exchanging fluids if you didn't have it on. Mm-hmm. You have to use a latex condom or a polyurethane condom. The female condoms are polyurethane condom. They're a little squeaky, but they are very good at preventing the transmission of sexually transmitted diseases, and including HIV, and to reduce the risk of pregnancy. So having a barrier method like that is very helpful, yes.
How contagious
is the gonorrhea?
Yep.
Now, that's a good question. We have looked at, is this some sort of a different type of bug, since it seems to be we think a lot of people are getting it and they're having milder symptoms. We haven't looked at the bug, at the molecular structure of the bug, but we're looking at seeing if we can do that. So we can't really say how contagious it is. You know, I think in order to answer that question, everyone would have to tell me how much sex they're having and how many partners they're having it with, and then we maybe could calculate it, but that would be a lot of work for me.
What about, yeah, you mentioned the molecular epidemiology. We've got far, far, far more tools than we used to. And it seems to me, again, money is often the issue. But one way to answer this question of why is to see if it is a similar organism that's being spread person to person. Is that feasible? Does it make sense? Cost too much? Where are we?
Yeah, so it is feasible. It's not something that's routinely done nationally. Now, for other bugs like E. coli and Salmonella, it is done routinely. It's called pulse field gel electrophoresis. And but for gonorrhea, that's not routinely done. But we are told by CDC that they can do this, and we are trying to work with CDC and some of our other state health department partners in other states to see if we can try and characterize, you know, different strains of gonorrhea that are circulating, particularly in the Pacific Northwest. You know, one thing that just came to mind is I wonder if some of the listeners might not have a good idea of what gonorrhea is in terms of just, you know, the etiologic agent.
Sure.
So I was thinking it might be helpful just to chat about that a little bit. So gonorrhea is a disease that's caused by a bacteria. And the bacteria is called Neisseria gonorrhoeae. And it's actually the second most common reportable condition in the United States and in Alaska as well. And in the United States, there were about 700,000 cases reported last year. And gonorrhea is a common cause of pelvic inflammatory disease and ectopic pregnancy. And so it can cause infertility in women. So there are some pretty serious adverse sequelae that can occur from people who have untreated gonorrhea infection. Gonorrhea infection can also lead to a potentially life-threatening blood infection. And then lastly, gonorrhea infection makes it easier to transmit and to acquire human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, which is the virus that causes AIDS. In terms of its transmission, it's transmitted during vaginal, anal, or oral sex, and the symptoms are actually often absent in people. So there's a large proportion of patients who are asymptomatic. And in terms of the incubation period, which is the period between infection, so when somebody has sex with another person, they get infected to the point where they actually develop symptoms, that incubation period can be up to 1 month. And if people do have symptoms, then their symptoms typically include burning on urination, as Susan mentioned, an abnormal discharge in both women and men can get painful and swollen testicles. The disease itself is easily diagnosed through a urine test, and it's easily treated with antibiotics.
And then the other thing that I'd like to add, it depends on what kind of sex that you're having. I mean, you can get gonorrhea in other parts of your body and in your throat. And if you're having rectal sex, you can get rectal gonorrhea too.
Right.
So there are other possibilities out there.
And another, I guess, important question that I can just envision people out there hoping, what's the likelihood it's going to go away without treatment?
It's not very likely. I think that it, in some instances, you know, people that have pretty mild symptoms, it might eventually clear.
Yeah.
But I don't know of any studies that looked at that. I mean, there's been a lot of studies around chlamydia and whether it clears or not. But gonorrhea...
The big thing with gonorrhea is because the sequelae or the consequences of untreated infection can be very severe, bloodstream infections, you know, infertility, things like that. It's if you have any symptoms or if you've had unprotected sex, it's important to go in and get tested.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that can happen is if you received or acquired gonorrhea through having penis to vaginal sex, and if you're male or female, and either one, if that infection becomes complicated, that original site of the infection may not show up as a gonorrhea infection, but you may have it in other parts of your body. So you have to tell the provider if you have other signs and symptoms, especially of complicated infection.
One of the things that I think it's important for us to chat about perhaps at this point is how do you prevent gonorrhea infection? So there is no vaccine for gonorrhea, unfortunately. Really, it comes down to a few basic prevention techniques. Number one, certainly abstinence. If you're not having sex, you're not going to get gonorrhea. And then number two, you know, if you're in a long-term, mutually monogamous relationship with a partner who has been tested and is known to be uninfected, you're safe. And certainly if you're having sexual relations with somebody whose testing status you're not sure about, latex condom for, you know, male condom can reduce the risk of infection. And then there are other risk factors that have been shown to put people at risk for GC infection, including alcohol and drug use associated with, you know, a sexual encounter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the term association we've talked about a number of times on this broadcast, and that doesn't mean that that is the cause. It's just that those two things happen closely related in time. And we sometimes, our way our minds work is we get fooled into thinking that's cause. But the most likely explanation for that is people who are using drug and alcohol may also be having unprotected sex. Is that the way you would think of it?
Correct.
Yeah. I think that what happens is you loosen your inhibitions, and you're less likely to protect yourself when you're under the influence.
Mm-hmm.
And you're more likely to go with your sexual urges without protection.
All right. One more question before a short break. It's not likely it just started here in Alaska. Is it happening in other places, particularly in the West Coast? Do we know that the rate of gonorrhea, particularly this milder form, is being found elsewhere?
Well, since we don't really have the molecular characteristics of this organization, we can't say for sure, although we do know that usually what happens on the West Coast hits Alaska a couple of years later. And in a recent meeting down in January, someone from the Washington Health Department said, oh, it sounds like you must have our gonorrhea that we had down here a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
And they just characterized the infection by looking at it. You know, they said, we seem to be more infectious, milder symptoms. Now it's gone. Last year in 2009, Washington State had 2,000 cases of gonorrhea. Alaska had 1,000. So Washington State was back down in their numbers.
And already.
Already.
Because of the natural history, the intervention.
We don't know for sure.
You can't be sure.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like she was alluding to the fact that it was a natural history that had run its course.
Okay. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, and I want you to remember KSKA is a listener-supported radio. KSKA's spring membership drive is in full swing, so here's my colleague Steve Heimel to tell you more.
KSKA is listener-supported radio. Hello, I'm Steve Heimel, host of Talk of Alaska, and we're inviting you to call right now, 550-8484. And pledge your financial support to keep local and statewide news and information programs going strong on FM 91.1. Toll free, the number is 800-478-5256, or you can pledge online, kska.org. 91.1 FM is where to tune for local, statewide, and national news and information. Each Monday, you tune into your health with KSKA's locally produced program, Line 1, Your Health Connection, with Dr. Thad Woodard. The call-in invites you to talk to experts in the health field on issues that affect your health and your family's well-being. Dr. Woodard keeps you connected with your community and offers insight and information on issues that matter to you. Call in with your pledge of support, 550-8484 or 800-478-5256, online, kska.org. KSKA, the Alaska Public Radio Network, NPR, and the BBC all work together to provide the best news and information public service on radio today. You rely on the Alaska Public Radio Network, and KSKA relies on you and your financial support to keep this public service healthy and vital. In Anchorage, call 550-8484, toll-free 800-478-5256, or online, kska.org. Thanks for listening, and thank you for supporting KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are our state epidemiologist, Dr. Joe McLaughlin, and Susan Jones, who's the manager of the Section of Epidemiology, HIV, and Sexually Transmitted Disease Program. We've been discussing a little bit about epidemiology and the purpose of the Section of Epidemiology. We've gotten into a recent resurgence of gonorrhea in this state, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more and then some other sexually transmitted diseases. If you've got questions or comments about any of these issues or have want to ask a question related to this, why don't you give us a call at 550 8433, or you can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. You can reach me during the next 30 minutes or so at line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E at KSKA.org. And please remember there's a rebroadcast between 8 and 9 tonight on KSKA. If you're listening at that time, they're not taking phone calls or any emails. Many eons ago, I was a state epidemiologist, or an acting state epidemiologist. There was not much of a state epidemiologist. This was so far ago. But we had a cadre of people who would do disease outbreaks, especially with sexually transmitted diseases. They'd go out once we had a positive test or definite diagnosis and try to figure out, is the diagnosis correct, try to best we could figure out who the partners may have been in an effort to try to identify the partners, treat the partners, and stop an outbreak. Is that still being done?
Yeah, that's still being done. It's being done at different levels throughout the state. It's a public health responsibility. In Anchorage, in our office, we have a group of disease intervention specialists, is what we call them, your disease investigators. So if I say DIS, that refers to these individuals. Public health nursing has some disease investigation specialists in Bethel and Fairbanks, Juneau, Mat-Su. And so what we do is we get the reports of the infectious disease, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, HIV, and depending on the priority level that that disease has and that case has, the individual could be contacted to help identify who their sexual partners are. And then also with the intent to notify the sexual partners very confidentially, that they may have been exposed to an infectious disease so that they can know to get tested and treated. And in some instances, they're treated at the time of the notification. It depends on how it's done and where it is in the state.
One more question I had regarding, I guess, reporting. It's at times, especially related to vaccines, I guess. I sometimes get arguments against vaccines is that we really don't know what's going on in our statistical reporting and so forth. And you mentioned like 750,000 cases nationwide of gonorrhea. What is your gestalt? What do we know about that relative to the total number of cases, for example? And how can we trust our information is telling us good information? If that's only 1% of the total amount of gonorrhea, can we really make reasonable decisions on how well our reporting is? I guess is what I'm trying to get.
Yeah, that's a good question. So there are some problems with monitoring. Certainly one of the big problems is that it's a passive reporting system. Even though it's mandated by law, you know, a lot of healthcare providers really don't report very often or only report certain infectious diseases. So, you know, the healthcare provider side is only as good as our reports. And a lot of times those reports are not coming in from providers. So it is a passive system. You know, and many of the conditions are never diagnosed. You know, so many people have, you know, some of these reportable conditions, but they're not diagnosed. And, you know, like, for example, salmonella, you know, mm-hmm. Somebody has a salmonella infection. They think, oh, I've got diarrhea. It'll go away. And eventually it does. And it never goes diagnosed. Therefore, it never goes reported. So that's certainly another one of the issues is just, you know, in terms of really trying to understand the incidence of these diseases in populations, it depends on good reporting and actual diagnosis of disease. And then the other issue is staff turnover. You know, there are providers out there who really understand our reportable conditions list and they leave and another provider comes in or a locum tenens doc comes in mm-hmm. and doesn't know that botulism is reportable or something like that. And so, you know, that's another issue that comes up for us.
Well, we have a second line of reporting. We have the provider who's required to report, and we have the laboratory that's mm-hmm. required to report. So for those diseases that have a confirmed organism, mm-hmm. that's being reported. reported by the lab. And the question that we frequently get, well, what if the lab is outside of Alaska? If the person has a residence address as being in Alaska, that report is always given to Alaska. We do our case finding and case investigation based on the resident of the person that has the infection. So many private providers use labs that are outside of Alaska for gonorrhea and chlamydia, and those labs report to us. So they are required to report different things. The lab, of course, is required to report the information that they have, which would be the name of the person and the birth date and the organism and the name of the provider and those kind of things. The provider then is required to report other information that would help us locate the patient, the address, the phone number. And then we have a standard of care in our program that every STD that's treatable and is reportable is treated according to the CDC guidelines. So we ask all the providers to please report the treatment. And if it's not reported, then we'll call the provider once we get the report from the lab or from the provider just to confirm that the person has been adequately treated.
All right. We have a caller on the line. Kaylee, what can we do for you?
Hi. Well, what my question was is, I'm calling from Wasilla, and I know especially out here, schools and government teach kids abstinence only. Do you think that the fact that they're not being realistic in the fact that teaching kids to use condoms would have an attributing factor to the high number of infections in the state?
Well, I think, hi, Kylie, it's Susan Jones. I think that we have some indication from different scientific studies that have been passed, that have been done over the past few years, that shows that an abstinence-based education works best when you have a flow range of information that's being presented. If an abstinence-based education has correct information in it, it gives people some information. But I think that what we want people to do is be fully informed, and I like to use the idea of informed consent. You know, before I go into surgery, I like to know all the risks that are going to happen when I do the surgery. And when I've talked to teens and talked to them about informed consent, I say, you know, before you have sex, you should know all the risk factors that you're going to have. And if you're going to have sex, then how can you protect yourself? So I think that you do have something there that we really need to give everyone all the tools that we can give them so that they can protect themselves and they can decide. You know, it's not just a sexual activity, it's an emotional activity. And when it comes to informed consent, that side of it should be in place too. Sex is so complicated. I mean, we know that it's so complicated, people don't even like to talk about it, they just like to do it. And it's part of the problem in trying to control disease investigation is trying to talk about it. Providers sometimes are not comfortable in talking about sex with their clients. Clients are not comfortable in talking about it. The poor teenager who is on his own or her own for the first time seeing their medical provider without their parents in the room really are not good advocates for themselves. So there's a whole range of support that we need to give to individuals, and part of it is to be fully informed.
I agree. I just think that the whole abstinence idea is something that's so idealistic, and it's something that everybody wishes that we could have in our society, but I think it's the same with having a drug-free community. Is no matter how much that's what we want, we have to be realistic, and we need to give the kids the information of how to protect themselves. My sisters are in middle school, and neither of them have been told, you know, use protection. They've only been told don't have sex. And so when you're not going in that with the mindset that this is what I need to do to protect myself, then if it's not given to them as what they should be doing, then it's not something they're going to think about doing.
Right. You're so right. And there are programs, agencies that do provide some education. The public health nursing has education. The Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest has some good educational systems, but it's hard to get those into the school. Sometimes health education teachers will open their doors to a little bit more of an education, but the school curriculum really needs to support full information.
I completely agree with you. Thank you for taking my call.
Kaylee, just one second. I guess I would like to only say that anytime we we get into these issues of what's best, that I encourage people to really look at what we know and what's the evidence, and not make ideological opinions about things. And that's not the purpose of this program, to talk about the validity of abstinence in this program, but I hope I'm being right in saying the evidence that alone is successful is not good. And we should leave it at that. And the idea, where nobody's saying we shouldn't talk about abstinence, we're just saying that the evidence suggests that it's most effective when combined. If I can echo what Susan said and make sure that people hear that comment. But the big point is, look at the evidence. Don't be blind to the fact that people have been checking this out, and everybody wants to do the right thing.
I think abstinence should be included in education as a range of how you protect yourself. So on one level, there's abstinence. On the other level, there's other risk reduction factors that a person can employ to protect themselves.
I completely agree. I think it should be please be abstinent. But if you're going to be stupid, at least be smart about being stupid and protect yourself.
Have a good day.
You too. Thank you.
All right. How about myths? I always like to ask about myths. Are there any myths about gonorrhea we might want to share?
Well, we do have quite a few myths. One of the common myths is that you can't get an STD by giving or receiving oral sex. That's not true. If you don't have any symptoms, you don't have an STD. That's another myth.
Can I add something
sure.
to that one?
So
Jim?
You can have no symptoms and have an STD.
That's correct.
Put it in the other other format.
You can have no symptoms and have more than one STD, because we haven't even
right.
really talked about chlamydia.
Right.
And we talked about gonorrhea and having over 1,000 cases in 2009. But in chlamydia, we've had over 5,000 cases in 2009 of chlamydia. And Alaska has ranked first or second in the nation for chlamydia rates over the last decade. And that infection is an infection that primarily has no symptoms.
Right. And that was actually my next myth that I was going to say, is that you can't have two STDs at once. That's wrong. That's a myth. So some of the other common ones are using two condoms, one on top of the other, gives you more STD protection. That's not true. Having sex in a chlorinated hot tub or pool will kill an STD. That is not true. Urinating after intercourse will flush out any STDs. Again, another myth. Having intercourse without ejaculation is safe. That's not true. We know that these bugs can be transmitted without ejaculation. And then here's another one. The pill prevents against STDs. Again, another myth.
Well, I wrote down, what about being transmitted by handshakes and toilet seats?
Right.
Somebody must still think that
toilet seats, doorknobs, swimming pools, bathtubs.
Okay.
Right.
Well, a handshake, actually, if you look at syphilis, and if syphilis has a chancre or a sore, those are infectious. And if the person had the sore on their hand, and I have seen that.
Yep.
And you shook hands, and you were...
I was addressing gonorrhea specifically.
Oh, sorry.
So let's
gonorrhea, you can shake hands.
We got to be careful when we're, there's a lot of sexually transmitted diseases, viruses, bacteria, all kinds of things. So it's a different issue.
But I think another way to look at it is what kind of cells do these organisms like? And they like the cells that are in the mouth and in the vagina and inside the penis. They like that there's
mucous membranes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, here's one more myth before we go on that I think is a good one to share. It is incorrect to say that if you don't have a condom, it's safe to use plastic wrap. Remember that.
All right.
Myth.
All right. So if anybody's got any other questions about gonorrhea in particular, we've only got about 10 minutes. You need to call or email me. We're going to move on. You've mentioned chlamydia. We've mentioned that chlamydia is often transmitted at the same time as gonorrhea. We've also said that it may not be very symptomatic. What else do we need to know about this infection?
Well, chlamydia is a disease that's also caused by a bacteria. The bacteria is called Chlamydia trachomatis, and it's actually the most common reportable condition in the United States. In the U.S., we get over 1 million cases of chlamydia reported every year. And like gonorrhea, it's a common cause of pelvic inflammatory disease and ectopic pregnancy, as well as infertility. Like gonorrhea, chlamydia is transmitted during vaginal, anal, or oral sex. The symptoms are absent even more frequently in chlamydia than they are with gonorrhea. About three-quarters of women and about half of men who are infected with chlamydia are asymptomatic. They don't have symptoms. The common symptoms are, you know, burning on urination, abnormal discharge in women and men. Sometimes that will occur. Fortunately, it's easily diagnosed through a urine test, and it's easily treated with antibiotics. So again, it's one of those things where, you know, a lot of people are asymptomatic. And if you have had unprotected sex, you should go in and get tested. The incubation period for chlamydia is 1 to 3 weeks. And so that's, so if you've had sex with somebody, typically the disease will, if you become symptomatic, will start to show itself in about 1 to 3 weeks.
And I think the thing that we'd like to add about chlamydia is it's really the number one cause of infertility in females. It causes the pelvic inflammatory disease. And even the pelvic inflammatory disease that is associated with chlamydia can be asymptomatic. They call it silent PID. So it's the reason that we're so interested in these infections are they do have consequences to the people who have the infection. And we want to keep the reproductive health of Alaskan women healthy. And that's one of the reasons that we do so much activity around partner notification, trying to get all the partners identified, all the partners tested and treated so that they won't acquire infection, or if they have the infection, it won't become a complicated infection. Chlamydia is a real risky disease to have. Once you have it once, you're more likely to get it again. Your body's kind of set up for the infection. Once you have pelvic inflammatory disease once, the risk of having infertility is a little bit high. If you have pelvic inflammatory disease twice, the risk of infertility increases quite a bit. I mean, it's up to about 80% or something like that. It's quite high. So I think that these are serious infections. Even though they are quite curable, they can cause problems.
Maybe we've mentioned this already, but person-to-person transmission is known as a horizontal transmission. There's also vertical transmission of sexually transmitted diseases. And I'm sitting here trying to think of a sexually transmitted disease as not vertically transmitted from mother to infant, and I can't come up with one. So two questions. Mm-hmm. We haven't listed all the common sexually transmitted diseases. We've mentioned a couple. And is it true that they virtually all are transmittable from mother to child?
Sure. So in terms of the other common sexually transmitted diseases, so we've already talked about chlamydia and gonorrhea, HIV and syphilis. You also have hepatitis B and C virus. You've got human papillomavirus,
right.
Herpes and trichomonas infection, and bacterial vaginosis. And then chancroid. We don't see much chancroid here in Alaska. In terms of vertical transmission or transmission from the mother to the child, some STDs, like syphilis, cross the placenta and infect the baby while it's in the uterus. And then other STDs, like gonorrhea, chlamydia, hepatitis B, and genital herpes, can actually be transmitted from the mother to the baby during delivery as the baby passes through the birth canal. And then HIV, it can cross the placenta during pregnancy, it can infect the baby during the birthing process, and unlike most other STDs, it can actually infect the baby through breastfeeding. For HIV, the transmission rate from the mother to the infant without treatment, so if the mother is not on treatment, is about 25% without breastfeeding. And if the mother is breastfeeding, the transmission rate bumps up to 35%. So a woman with an STD may have early onset of labor, may have premature rupture of the membrane surrounding the baby in the uterus, and uterine infection during delivery. And then in terms of consequences to the actual fetus or baby once it's born, if they do acquire these STDs, certainly stillbirth is the most dramatic potential consequence. Low birth weight, pneumonia, sepsis or a blood infection, blindness, deafness, acute hepatitis, meningitis. There are all sorts of sequelae that can result depending on the infectious disease process.
What's happening? We've got about 3 minutes. What's happening with sexually transmitted disease incident rate over time, over the last 15, 20 years, you know, nationally and locally? But I'm more curious nationally. Are we doing better as a society? And I'm trying to be as generic as I can with that question.
Well, I think that if you look at chlamydia first, nationally, the rates of chlamydia have gone up every year. Mm. And they have done so in Alaska also. Chlamydia was first reportable in Alaska in 1996. And since that year, every year, the rates have gone up. So chlamydia is an interesting organism. I think that there's some question about can they really get it to clear? What are some of the problems associated with chlamydia, in addition to the fact that it's asymptomatic? Gonorrhea is episodic. It comes and it goes. Some of the problems with gonorrhea have to do with resistance factors. Some of the medications that were used to treat gonorrhea in the past are no longer useful. So we're starting to limit the amount of antibiotics that we can use for gonorrhea. So when you look at not only the incidence of disease, you can look at some of the problems that you have with resistance. Syphilis has been under control in this state for a while. We had a little bit of an outbreak in 2004. Nationwide, it's controlled in some states really well, in some states not as well, but it's getting under control. HIV, I think it's interesting that in our state for HIV, the number of new cases per year hasn't really declined, and people are living longer because the medications are so good. So you have more people living with the disease. So in a nutshell, that's kind of the diseases that I can give you.
We have about a minute or so. What's some final comments? I could lead you to HIV and human papillomavirus, both extremely important. We've not talked about those. We've talked about them in the other programs. But I want to give you an open chance here in the last minute or so to make some final comments.
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is when it comes to STDs, and especially with a spike in gonorrhea cases, we want you as a high-risk individual or as a provider to try to get all the partners identified and notified, and public health folks can help you do that so that you're not breaching confidentiality. So get people identified, get tested if you need to get tested, call us if you need some help.
You know, and the other thing I'd just like to emphasize, I know I mentioned it earlier, is we do have a good webpage that you can refer to. It's www.epi.alaska.gov. And you can not only access epidemiology bulletins there, but you can also access the HIV STD program site that has lots of links and a lot of good information about HIV and STDs.
And Dr. Woodard, we can give you some links to put on your website too, because there are some links for individuals. Iknowmine.org will help people find out where they can go for services in their community throughout Alaska.
And I guess one final thought I had was that just the confidentiality issue is everybody wants to respect that confidentiality. That we want to protect public health. Everybody does that. But we also want to protect individual confidentiality. So that is done.
Definitely.
All right. Thanks, Dr. McLaughlin and Susan Jones. It's been educational and fun. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Next week, we're going to return, and I'm going to be talking to an emergency room physician in Alabama. And you know what she does? She's the producer of a podcast called Brain Science. She also has another one called Books and Ideas. They're wonderful podcasts to listen to. We'll be discussing her list of the most important recent advances in neuroscience next week. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack helped us immensely today by engineering the program. And I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.